order is generally pyramidal, like a pyramid. You can see that in the idea of the protection of the crown. At one time in the Canadian Constitution, provincial and federal jurisdictions were considered to be equal or parallel, but eventually they developed the principle of crown paramountcy. So federal law was paramount over provincial law when there was a conflict. There's a really strong tendency, as I started to think about it, it's even in our language, in the way we structure or think about grammar in English, a lot of hierarchical relations. And so on the Supreme Court of Canada website, we're told that the Supreme Court of Canada stands at the apex of the Canadian judicial system. The Canadian courts may be seen as a pyramid. It's very explicit. It's explicit in the way the Canadian Constitution is described to people, in the way ordinary voters are described as grassroots, and so forth. The Haudenosaunee model for their constitution is very egalitarian. And as I started to study it, what I suddenly realized is that one thing that's important in the cultural differences is what's right in the center of the circle. There's nothing there. There is no head of state among the Haudenosaunee. They have a lot of representatives. The representatives, each of those strings represents one of the representatives on their council. And the strings have many beads, some of them dark, some of them light. And that represents the fact that each representative represents many people. And there is, in that social system, there's a requirement for a great deal of consultation. You can't just go ahead and vote the way you want once you get on council. You have to consult with the people you represent. So some of their processes are slow because there has to be time for a lot of representation. There was also a very strongly developed concept of alliance relationships with other states, and it was represented with linking hand symbolism in a lot of the wampum that were made to commemorate treaties that were made. And I think there's been a bit of a discussion. Some people think that there's an original and better wampum, but these wampum were taken apart and put together again. It's the idea represented by the design that's important. Since I've actually gone over the time I was supposed to take for this presentation, and so I can't get too much into the second part of the book that has a lot of detailed discussions of exactly where the court fell into colonial modes of reasoning. I looked at the judicial role, the judge's concept of their role, and they do have a tendency to think that they have a right to make a decision for the rest of us when they're in uncertainties. There is not a tendency to refer things, to define an issue and refer it to Parliament, for example. The social background of the judges, most of them come from relatively well-off middle-class families, and most of them went straight through law school, straight from high school to university to law school. There's relatively little experience of the broader world that the rest of us live in. And this is reflected in their decision in the firearms reference, which I discuss. There's a radical difference between the way urban people and rural people see that issue. There's a difference between Western Canada and Central Canada, I would say between Montreal and Saskatchewan, or between Montreal and Northern Newfoundland, where a lot of people still do make their living off the land and off the sea. In R.V. Nicau, it was a case where an Indigenous person was arrested for fishing without a permit on his reserve. And his reserve actually had fishing regulations, but they weren't even mentioned by the judges. The judges didn't consider the effect of the regulations. They just said that the guy should get a fishing permit. Because how else could you tell that he was an Indian? So I guess he didn't even know that people with Indian status usually have status cards. So if he had a status card, you'd be able to tell that he was under indigenous jurisdiction. And it may seem strange to expect that indigenous jurisdictions could be recognized by the Supreme Court of Canada, but they have been recognized by the courts in Australia, which is under the same kind of system. And certain issues they recognize have to be decided within the jurisdiction of the Aboriginal people there. And they've also found that there was Aboriginal title underlying the city of Perth. They found that there could be Aboriginal title even if settlers were living on the land. Another area I looked at was the use of categorization by the judges. And categorization usually uses a container metaphor. Something's in a category or out of it. That's not the way we really think. We really form our categories based on our personal experience, and then we generalize on the basis of that. So if I say I'm going home, the idea of home, the way I see it, might be a house in a suburb because that's where I grew up. But for someone else, it might be a house in an apartment building because that's where they grew up. And there's a lot of misunderstanding because of that, and there's a lot of intercultural misunderstanding. I think that's one of the reasons why people in the dominant population were so slow to recognize the problem made by the residential schools, because most of us, when we went to schools, school was a very friendly place, and it never crossed our mind that it would be so horrible for someone else. And the people that went to horrible residential schools probably just assumed that we knew what they were being subjected to, and there was so little intercultural communication that people didn't know. There is a need for a lot more of institutions of communication. I also looked at the frames of reference that were applied by the judges and demonstrated how some of the major principles, like the use of sui generis, I've already talked about the trust-like, the no-legijic principle of interpretation in favor of the Indians and the Crown's trust-like rather than adversarial role. There's also been a tendency to say that Indigenous treaties are sui generis. I don't know why, but it's a kind of way of avoiding the embarrassment involved in finding that Canada's actually violated international law and the way it's interpreted and understood those treaties. There's also the Vanderpeet test that states that in order to be an Aboriginal life, it has to be integral to a distinctive culture. And the court seems to have decided that in order to be a distinctive culture, it has to be something that was being done at the time of contact and hasn't changed. So in the court's mind, it seems not to be permissible for Indigenous people to move into the modern world or to have a jurisdiction like other people have. If I look at the trends of what happened, in the 25-year period that I looked at those cases, though nothing has changed since 2006, the last case that was considered in the book. In fact, it may have gotten worse. The judges have the perception that the world has changed and that they've liberalized greatly the support for Indigenous rights. However, Indigenous people like Wanda McCaslin, who is not a very in-your-face kind of person, she's very easy to get along with kind of person, but as she says and as so many Indigenous people see, the patterns of harm and abuse are continuing today. I think Thomas Kuhn's observation that anomalies, and there is an anomaly in the conflict between the values expressed by the judges and the actual effect of their decisions. This is not necessarily going to induce a crisis. There's going to be a tendency for people to, for anyone perhaps, but the indigenous people who continue to struggle to find a way to obtain equitable treatment. What we really need to do, I think, if we want to change things and to solve the so-called Indian problem, I don't think the problem is with the indigenous people, I think the problem is with Canada. But what we need to do is to develop a paradigm for intercultural relations that's mutually acceptable. And it would help if Canadians remembered the British part of our heritage that required acceptance of other jurisdictions. That model didn't really work well because it allowed colonization to happen, but we could look at why abuse arose in that situation and try to design institutions that will improve that. I also think that change will only happen if we acknowledge history. I think we tend to take an ostrich in the sand approach to history. We don't want to study history. Recently I was on the BC ferries. I'd just been over to visit members of the Halkominum Treaty Group whose land was taken away and given to the Esquimalt Nanaimo Railway. And there was a nice little article in a magazine on the BC ferries about the first railway on Vancouver Island. And they failed to mention anything about what happened to the people whose land was taken, even though there was lots of information there to be had. And I think we need to start integrating what happened to Indigenous peoples, what happened to other cultural groups, to our concept of Canada. We can acknowledge that there were things that were wrong in the past and get past them. There's no point in pretending that we're all goody-two-shoes who never did anything wrong or that our ancestors were. So, thank you. And I hope, this has been a very rough overview of what's in the book. I hope people will be able to get hold of a copy of the book from the library or to buy one. UBC Press is here. UBC Press also published Richard Atlio's book, which I think is very interesting. It helps people to understand that the stories of his people were not just sort of quaint little fables about ravens and mucus, clam or something. You know, they all have layers of meaning that we might miss. There's a highly developed philosophy there. And according to that philosophy, our society is only in its infancy. So we should be brave enough to try to grow up. Thank you.